Good morning, everyone. This morning's reading is taken from the Gospel of Luke, from chapter 12 and verses 13 to 21. It's entitled The Parable of the Rich Fool. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." And then he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?' This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God."
Is that him? Yeah. Sorry. We got there in the end. You know, when my brother was a teenager, he used to go on lots of excavations, archaeological excavations. And as we lived in St. Albans, there was a lot of them. And the best one that we ever went on was the Roman tip that was outside the main entrance into Verulamium. And so even though I was about sort of 8 years younger than him, I was able to go along about the age of eight or whatever. And I found a Roman coin. Ooh. In fact, everywhere you dug, you found Roman stuff. And my brother found 18 Roman coins, which was typical, really, you know. Not that there was any sibling rivalry or anything. And he also found a Roman brooch that got displayed in the museum. But I was very proud of my one Roman coin. And I was even more chuffed that at the end of the dig, the person in charge of it, they presented me with the bone of a Roman dog that had been thrown down a well. My mother wasn't so thrilled with it as I was, but certainly not when I put it up on my main display in my bedroom, you know, for many years. I think she was quite horrified, really. And, you know, in a sense, what was happening there, we were told, was that this Roman person had left those 18 coins there to go back to Rome to try and save Rome from the barbarians, and they were hoping that they were going to be there when they came back. And in a sense, they were doing a little bit of what Jesus was warning against here in his story, about storing up things for you that in the end you will never enjoy because you will die or whatever. And they certainly also didn't take their pottery with them because I always remember the leader of the dig saying to me, "Do you like jigsaws?" And I said, "Oh, yes, yes, I love jigsaws." And so she opened the doors of this great big garage, and it was full from floor to ceiling with broken bits of Roman pottery. And I wasn't so keen on putting them all together just there. But, you know, when we look at this story, we see many truths that apply not just to that situation, but to the world in which we live. Jesus is talking to what is described at the beginning of the chapter as thousands of people, and he gives a number of warnings and encouragements. I haven't added them all up exactly, but I think there are rather more warnings than there are encouragements. And suddenly, he's interrupted in full flow by this person who wants him to arbitrate in this problem over an inheritance. We don't know the sort of full details of it all, but or the finer points of it. But Jesus, rather than arbitrate, tells a story, and he warns against greed. And in verse 15, it says just here, "Then he said to them, 'Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions.'" And that's really the verse that I want to particularly focus on today, on the whole issue of greed. And he tells this story of the rich man who stored up all the produce that he got in one harvest for the years to come, so that he could put his feet up and enjoy life. And we see greed as one of the seven deadly sins, actually. It's listed as number three, I think, in that list. And greed is something that is always in the news, and it certainly is at the moment. A lot of concern about who owns football clubs at this time. And I think it was 19 years ago now that Chelsea got their current owner. And I said at the time, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in football. And I've been banging on about it for about 20 years. And my family are thoroughly fed up with it, actually. And the second worst thing that has ever happened in football is the new owners of Newcastle United. But why was it tolerated? Why weren't questions asked before? Why has it taken a war to actually bring to light many of the things that are actually out there in the public domain anyway? It's because of greed, because it brought money into the sport. It brought oceans of money into the sport. Why is it that the oligarchs are not telling the truth of what's going on, or even recognizing the truth, just staying silent? It's because they want to hang on to their riches. It's because of greed. And if you wanted something to sum up all of what we see on our television screens at the moment every day, all the violence and the destruction, if you want to sum it up in one thing, it's that all power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the more power that you have, the more insecure that you feel about that power. And that power is generated by greed for more and more and more. And we see that so vividly in what is going on at this time. So greed is always in the news, and it's particularly relevant at this time. So I want to think about it in a wider context and also in a personal context. First of all, is it worth the world to us in the wider context? And then secondly, is it worth everything to us on a personal level? You know, surprisingly, Jesus said an awful lot about money. But when you look at it, you're reminded time and time again of what God says in Isaiah chapter 55, verse 6. "My ways are not your ways, declares the Lord." The value and the principles that are there in the Bible are so contrary to the world's values when it comes to money, as in many other things as well. So what I want to do this morning is take some of the principles of the Old Testament law and see how they apply to the wider situation that we see before us in the world, and also on a personal level. And the first thing to say is that the land was a gift from God. The promised land that God had given them was seen as a gift from God. It wasn't seen as an investment, which so often in our society, increasingly in our society, land is seen as an investment. It was seen as a gift from God. And that gift was something that every 50 years was returned to the original owners. There's a wonderful book which I can really recommend. I don't know whether you can get it now, but it's called Living as the People of God by Chris Wright. And it goes into some of the principles behind the Old Testament law. And this is what he says in one section of the book. "The biblical requirement for the Jubilee year, that was the 50th year, was to be treated like a sabbatical year with the land lying fallow, but also required the compulsory return of all property to its original owners or their heirs." Land was seen as a gift from God, and that was to remind them that it came from God. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, it says, "You may say to yourself, my power and strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. But remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth and so confirms his covenant which he swore to your ancestors as it is today." It was to remind them that everything came from God, including the land. Secondly, you can see in the attitude towards slaves. Amazingly, slaves were freed every seventh year. And not only that, if they ran away, they got to live in a town of their own choice. They didn't get harangued or punished, but they got to live in a town of their own choosing. Again, in Deuteronomy, it says, "If a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand him over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them." This was to remind Israel that they had been slaves in Egypt and they were set free by God. And this was to be their attitude towards slaves in their culture. Thirdly, the cancellation of debts. It wasn't just the land that was returned, but also debts every 50 years were cancelled. And in his book, Chris Wright says, really putting himself in the shoes of an Israelite, maybe feeling a bit unfairly treated by some of these laws. You know, could you afford to let your slave go free after 6 years? Still less with a personal endowment of your substance, animal, vegetable, and mineral. Were you not entitled to extract maximum yield from your fields and vineyards without having valuable remainders for others? How could you possibly cancel debts after 6 years? Would it not ruin your own family if you had to redeem and look after the land or personnel of some incompetent kinsman? The whole range of economic requirements in the Old Testament demanded trust in the providential sovereignty of God. You could well imagine some the Jews feeling very that they were being unfairly treated by some of these laws, but that is what God put in place for the society there. And fourthly, the attitude towards what the Bible obviously often wonderfully calls aliens. I love that phrase. I get the impression of all these little green men coming to Israel in the Old Testament. Aliens, or I suppose we might call them refugees maybe, or sojourners is another word that the Bible sometimes uses. And there are many, many laws about how these foreigners in their land should be looked after and fed and encouraged. Just one example in Leviticus chapter 23. "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor or the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God." It's very surprising, really, when you think that Israel were often attacked, oppressed, intimidated by the surrounding countries, that they welcome foreigners in their midst. Very surprising indeed. I mean, in fact, really, the whole thing is quite surprising because it does, when you look through some of those issues that are covered there, it doesn't work out really as very good economics, certainly not very good capitalism when you look at some of those laws just there. And that's not even dealing with things like Sunday trading, you know, the dreadful thing of keep having a day's rest from your work. Our society, I don't think, has benefited from the repeal of those laws, certainly not economically. But how do some of these laws apply now? When we look at the news, we can see we need to see things through the prism of the principles and the laws that are established here in the Bible. Just the issue of global warming, a concern about the environment. You know, man is continually exploiting the earth more and more, trying to get the most out of it, and we can start to see some of the effects of that in the world around us. I think there was a program last night about the problems in Madagascar that's caused by rising sea levels. Unfortunately, a lot of the places where it's already having effect are far from us and easily to keep out of mind. But what's going to happen as those issues get more in some countries but not in others? What's going to happen as the cost of trying to do something about that becomes more and more apparent? And the concern about jobs. You know, if I was an Australian coal miner, I might not feel quite so readily sympathetic towards the whole issue of environment, of the environment, and concern about the environment. I'd be more concerned about looking after my family and earning a living, or I could be, quite easily. What's going to happen as the balance between exploiting the earth and getting the things that we need, and the need to earn a living, what's going to happen as that balance becomes more and more undermined by what is going on planet Earth? Maybe, in the end, the Earth could become a parable about greed as we get more and more and more out of it. God has given us a world to look after and to steward. Is the cost going to be too great? Secondly, in the news, looking after foreigners and refugees. I don't see anything about signing forms and visas here. I don't see anything about particular countries, actually, in the Old Testament law. It's wonderful to see what's been going on with the concern about Ukrainian refugees, but there are many other wars in the world that have been going on an awful long time as well. What about workers' rights? We've been very concerned about P&O ferries, and yet as a society we've been moving more and more towards those sort of employment issues in the last number of years. The whole sort of gig economy. The Bible says a worker is worthy of his wages, and Jesus has a bias towards those oppressed people. And you see in the Old Testament law that it is wrong to oppress people, and the Bible speaks against that, exploiting people and oppressing people. And when you look back at the wonderful Christians of the 19th century, the Fries and the Roundtrees and all the rest of them, they were concerned about the way that workers were being exploited there for greed. And our city, Welling Garden City, which was the inspiration of Ebenezer Howard, many of his ideas came out of those concerns of those 19th century Christians who wanted to see workers paid properly for their wages and looked after in their lives. But you know, the Old Testament law gets even worse, because then it starts talking about giving and tithes. It says, in Deuteronomy, be sure to set aside a tenth of all that is in your fields and the produce each year. The Bible talks about giving to God's work. The Bible talks about giving for the good of others. Yeah, I'm sure not just in my lifetime, but in most of our lifetimes, we've seen the preponderance of food banks. I don't ever remember food banks some years ago. And I really, really wish that society would ask itself why there are so many now in virtually every town, and ask themselves some really deep questions about that. But maybe it's an opportunity for the church to fill some of the void and some of the gap that is there. I do a lot of family history, and one of the things that you do that you can see in family history when you go back to the parish records, and this is for any parish in any in any part of the country, is the overseer is giving out things to maybe your great-grandfather times 10 or whatever. Maybe it's a pair of shoes because they couldn't afford shoes for their children. Maybe it's a dress for their daughter because they couldn't afford a dress for their daughter. And, you know, that was taken over by councils at the end of the 19th century. But maybe some of that is coming back to the church again. I think that's a terrible comment on society, and I wish society would ask itself why. But that's the state that we're in. So the Bible encourages us to give. It also discourages or speaks against usury. The Old Testament law forbade Jews charging interest on loans to fellow Jews. Again, it's from Deuteronomy. Do not charge a fellow Israelite interest, whether on money or food or anything else that may be, that may earn interest. So what they did was they lent money to non-Jews, and an awful lot of the history over the last 2,000 years of their history has been based on that and some of the ramifications from that. But it's interesting that the church also, through the centuries, has talked against that sort of usury. And yet, in the last sort of 150 years or so, it's slightly changed some of its teaching on that. As a society, we have become more based around that sort of thing, of loans and investments and so on. Now, I'm not saying that we should all join the revolution and sign up for the revolution. What Karl Marx, one of the many things that Karl Marx got wrong was that it's the heart of men that needs changing, not the way that things are done. And this is really what Jesus is saying here, actually, is that it's the heart of man that needs changing, not the things that are there. But you know, if God were a political party, and he certainly isn't a political party, this was his manifesto for how society should be. Now, we live in the world that we live, and some of these things may be impossible, but we need to see through the prism of the principles of these laws. We need to see the issues that we face as society, I think, as Christians, far more than we do. It's so easy to get swept up by the crowd, isn't it? So easily to start taking on the values of this world. So easily to see things through the eyes of this world rather than through God's values and God's eyes. I remember my brother also used to take me to football matches, being much older. And one time we went to see Chelsea and Manchester United. And this was the Manchester United of Law, Best and Charlton. And everybody wanted to see that team. And I remember reading in the papers afterwards that there were 65,000 people in the ground and there were 10,000 locked out. And I think there were far more than that, actually. And certainly the whole system could not cope with the number of people that were there. And I was following my brother, and he was just in front of me. And then suddenly the crowd just moved me in a totally different direction. I always remember the look of concern on his face as he saw me going in the office. He was trying to sort of pull me back, but he couldn't because the weight of the crowd was pulling me in a completely opposite direction. It's a very, very strange feeling, actually, to be swept along by the crowd. But, you know, we can be swept along by the values of the world that we live in. We can be swept along by the principles. It's bombarded at us every day, isn't it, from our television screens. So I also want to ask, is it worth everything to us? The Bible, and it's important to say this, isn't against making money, but it is concerned about how that is done and about one or two other things as well. So I want to think, first of all, about how we get it. It's concerned about how we get money. So first of all, what the Bible condemns, dishonest gain. I mean, you've only got to look at the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, to think of that one. It's against exploitation. You know, when they first went into the promised land, there were a whole set of things about not exploiting the land so much. You can see that in the laws that we've just been looking through. Against cheap labor and so on. And it was also against wealth for wealth's sake. To accumulate wealth and status for our own security. I think great wealth is entirely meaningless. I don't know why it is that you need two super yachts, actually. Why do you need two super yachts or one huge property in Los Angeles and one huge property in London? I've never quite got that, but that's probably why I'm not a billionaire, actually, apart from other things as well. Sometimes we go for walks, my wife and I go for walks in the country, and just to wind her up, but don't tell her, if we come across a really palatial house in the middle of the country, I say, that's our next house. Or I say, you know, I'm not proud, but that one would do. Then she starts saying, well, think of all the housework. So I say, well, if you could own a house that big, you'd get people to clean the house, you know. And then she said, well, think of all the gardening, looking after all those grounds. Well, you know, if you've got the money to buy the house, then you've got money to get people to do the grounds, you see. And it really does wind her up, actually. It's quite good. She's right, and the Bible's right, because we're not, as Jesus says here, our lives are not determined by what we possess. Our lives is about who we are and what we do. And if I lived in a place that big, my life would be just entirely focused, I'm sure, just on that property or living there. That's the conclusion that I usually come to anyway after I've wound her up about it. But our lives are who we are. And what we do, that's far more important than what we possess. But the Bible also does commend things. It commends enterprise, actually, many times in the Bible, particularly in Jesus' parables. There's an example of the talents in Matthew chapter 25, but there are quite a few of them where he commends enterprise. So there's nothing wrong with that. And it also commends wealth for God's sake. You know, it's commending wealth when we're acknowledging where it comes from, where we're giving God thanks and praise for what he has blessed us with. It commends us using it for our needs, not necessarily our wants, but our needs. It commends it when we're using it to further God's work and when we're using it to bless others as well. The Bible commends those things, but it's also concerned about how we think about it. I do love Proverbs chapter 30, where it says, keep falsehood and lies from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. There's a sort of echo there of the Lord's prayer, isn't there? But give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you, Lord, and say, who is the Lord? When you become wealthy and rich, we've seen the warnings time and time again in the Bible. You think, I can do this without God. Who needs God if I've got all this money, all these possessions, and so on? And then it says, but also, if I have too little, I may steal and dishonor the name of God. I love that. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Paul says pretty much the same thing in Philippians chapter 4. He says, not that I am referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well fed and of going hungry, of having plenty and of being in need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty, but I have learned to be content in all circumstances. So we need to also be wary of the dangers of the sort of whole, for want of a better word, prosperity gospel, which would tell us that every Christian should be rich and every Christian should have many possessions. Which is really strange, actually, because if 90% of the world is considered poor and we're the 10%, all of us here are the 10% who are rich, 90% of Christians should be poor anyway, in worldly terms. And Paul says there he's learnt to be content in poverty and in plenty. And we need to be wary of giving based on a sort of strange idea that it's some sort of divine transaction, that if we give, God is going to give us back more. So if I give £10, he's going to bless me with £20. You know, God blesses in many different ways other than money. And the riches that he talks about are far different to the riches that of the world. In chapter 2 of Colossians, Paul says, my goal is that you may be encouraged in heart and united in love, so that they may have the full riches of complete understanding, in order that they may know the mystery of God, namely Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. The riches there are talking about the riches of knowing God. The riches there and the treasures are talking about the wisdom and knowledge of understanding more about God. And finally, the Bible is also concerned about how we used money. I want to just think of some of those Old Testament principles and apply them for a New Testament life. First of all, as we've already seen, everything, the land for Israel, whatever it was, everything comes from God. And we need to acknowledge that and give him thanks continually for that. The Bible also encourages us to be generous. We've talked about giving already, but in the letters to the Corinthians, Paul commends, first of all, proportional giving, and also somewhere else, sacrificial giving. And in another place, he also commends joyful giving as well. And it's amazing, you know, when you look at some of those principles from the Old Testament laws, you see something of the person of Christ and his mission to us. First of all, that everything is from God. Secondly, those laws talk about redemption and forgiveness, the forgiveness of debts, the forgiveness to slaves and so on. It also talks about welcoming and accepting all, when we think about the laws about foreigners and so on. It talks about giving, that Christ came and was given for us, and he paid our debts, he paid our ransom on the cross for each one of us. So let's make sure that the gifts that God blesses us with don't become more important to us than the giver. Amen.